Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 28 and it's being published at the end of January 2010. Yes, I am still alive. In this show, some news, part two of an interview with Mark Bishop, listener feedback and a selection of music. The main reason that this podcast has taken a long time to come is I've been very, very busy with another project and I wanted to get that project launched before I brought out the next podcast. Many of you will already know about this, but a new Roy Harper website has come, or rather royharper.com and royharper.co.uk now point to an entirely new site. And I've been deeply involved in that, along with Tracy and Roy, of course. The basic thing that's changed is there's an entirely new shop and there's also a blog. More about that in a moment. The shop first. Now, when I went to spend some time with Roy to do the big Roy interview many episodes ago, we had a chat about pretty much everything really, but talked at some length about the shop and where he should be going with his music, and also about the possibility of doing downloaded music. And I'm very much of a fan of that idea, and I had the opinion that it would open him up to a much wider audience. And there's a lot of people around now who probably don't care for a CD or a vinyl album and want to be able to download something and stick it on their MP3 player or whatever. So we concocted this vague plan to try and update the shop. There was another good reason for that, which was that it was based upon a shopping engine that was out of support, difficult to maintain. So I thought, okay, I'm sure I can help there, and stupidly thought it would be like, you know, a 3 or 6 month project. And it wasn't. It took a long time to develop. And we started off using one open source shopping engine, and then I found an all singing, all dancing new thing called Magento, and we started working with that. If you look at the shop now, you'll see it actually looks fairly similar to the old Roy Harper shop if you ever looked there, but it's an entirely new engine behind it. And the really big news is, apart from all the physical products that were for sale with the old shop as well, we can now do downloads. And these downloads, you can choose between MP3, which is, as I hope you know, a lossy format. It's compressed, but the file sizes are small. The sound quality is pretty decent, but not perfect. Or FLAC, which is a lossless codec. If you download the FLAC version of an album, for which we charge a pound extra, I think, to defray some of the extra costs of the large files, etc., you get a bit perfect representation of what came out of the studio. So you can choose between MP3 or FLAC, and almost all of Roy's entire catalogue is available. In between every line and Harper 70 to 75 are coming soon because they're being remastered. But there are remastered versions of quite a few of the albums there, and the quality is excellent. There's also a blog, and this is a way for Roy to publish his thoughts, a bit like his old online diary, but it's more kind of structured. Plus, it's a lot easier for him to actually publish these things there. So that's going to be a good sort of, hopefully regular way for him to communicate with people. So those two aspects have been keeping me horrendously busy. In between that and starting my new job as well, of course, which I hope you'll be pleased to hear is going pretty well. Settled in quite nicely, and I've already got a work plan mapped out for the entire of 2010, so they're going to keep me pretty busy. But the good thing is I've had time to do some other stuff as well. Most notably, of course, the Roy Harper shop, and I'm absolutely chuffed, very proud to have been involved in that project. You can imagine what it's like to be able to get involved with something that you really believe in and that you love the music. It's just great. I've been privileged to be able to take part in that. And actually, earlier today I had a phone conversation with Roy, and we talked about the fact that I was going to be putting out a podcast soon because I wanted to talk a little bit about the shop and let people know about it. And he was interested at some future point to come on and talk a bit more about how he thinks music's going and how an artist in his particular position is going to work things out over the coming years. How they can continue to make money out of their music, what's going to happen to the music industry, etc. You know, this is one of my favourite topics. So hopefully Roy and I will get together on the phone probably, and that will appear soon. So that's something to look forward to. Okay. I'm going to play a track now, and I've chosen These Last Days. This is a live version from the BBC Tapes Volume 5, which, of course, is available both on CD and download.
Seems there ain't no turning.
Now it's time to continue with part two of the long delayed interview with Marco.
Talking of Nick, let's talk about Nick for a little while. How did you first, because I know you're a big fan of Nick as well, how did you first encounter Nick?
Well, when I was growing up, I got into going to festivals, in my first festival was Reading in 1980. And I remember I came back and I was just blown, it was Reading Rock Festival. Blown away by going to this festival. I'd gone down there armed only with a sleeping bag. A bivy bag, which for those of you who might not know, is just like a big plastic bag that you slip a sleeping bag inside, and a can of baked beans. And that was my entire equipment, which I left Redcar about 250 miles from Reading and then zoomed down to Reading Festival with. And nonetheless, had a fantastic time. Many amusing things happened, and I got hooked into festivals, and I came back. And the elder brother of one of my mates says, "God, you're a guy who was born 10 years too late. You should have been born in the 60s. And that was kind of a tag that stuck with me for a little while, many years, until music sort of changed in the 90s. But for a long time, I felt the music around me was something that I found I struggled to relate to of that era. I didn't really connect that strongly to punk music when it happened. Or Euromantic stuff and things like that. But anyway, I'd found this connection to Roy, albeit, again, perhaps 10 years too late, but I was still enjoying getting to know Roy's music. And at one concert, and I don't know where it was. It was in London, and it involved, it was the first time I'd ever seen Nick, and my memory is that Nick played a little bit on his own, and God knows what the track was. It wasn't one. It might have been a cover, but he was standing on a bar or something. I've got this vague memory of Nick standing on a table or something and hitting this amazing thing, which might or might have not had some Led Zeppelin involved along the line. Anyway, this just blew me away. I have to check Nick out if he ever plays on his own. And sometime after that, I heard that he was playing at a place, I think it was called Bungie's.
It was, and I went to quite a lot of those as well.
My memory of these gigs were utterly acoustic. There was no amplification.
No amplification, tiny room. Like brick walls and oozing with atmosphere and sweat.
Exactly. And also, not that many people. I remember going to one or two there when there was, 30 people perhaps in the audience, if that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I started seeing it then, and then I went to some gigs at the 12 Bar, which was like this old Forge.
That's right.
Which is a venue in Soho in London, and I think that's really when I first got to know who you were. I wouldn't say I knew you. I don't know whether I took courage to say hello at that point in my life, but I certainly knew who you were, and it used to really frustrate me because you always had the very best seats at 12 Bar. You and your mates just blagged about 50 seats that looked straight down on the upstairs of the 12 Bar.
What happened was the bloke who used to run the club got to know me, and he decided I was somebody that should be looked after. You see.
Excellent.
So, we had this VIP section a few times, which was fantastic. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. That was great.
It was. I remember that gig at the 12 Bar. I mentioned earlier how out of the habit of George Robey shouting very loudly for encore as well. Yeah. The 12 Bar knocked out some other unpleasant habits of mine. I think God blessed me with a voice that would scare ghosts at 500 paces. In other words, not one that should be ever let out in public. And nonetheless, as being utterly wrapped up in music, I sometimes would accidentally hear myself warbling along to some of Nick's tunes. And I remember being at the 12 Bar one time and this young lady next to me told me in no uncertain terms where I should take my unpleasant voice. And thankfully, I've made a good point of never letting it loose again in public. So that was amusing, and also at that time I just also stopped, got out of the habits. He used to be always shouting out, play this, play that, and again I just thought, no, it's just enjoy what Nick wants to play, what Roy wants to play. So hopefully I've learned to be not such an irritating a fan as the years have gone by, because I was certainly a noisy, vociferous mad nutter for too many years.
Those 12 bar gigs, I seem to remember they were often on a Thursday night or a Wednesday night. And I remember this because at the time I was working at the university and I had my flat in East London, and I used to go home on the night bus. And as Nick progressed and his repertoire grew, he played sometimes for hours and hours and hours. And I remember once I stumbled out of there at like 3 a.m. or something, and he'd been playing since 9 or 10.
Was that the one where he started playing downstairs and then he went upstairs to the bar area, not in the room itself, but to the front, and carried on the gig there?
Good question. Can't remember, actually.
I remember him playing, as you say, really late. Perhaps that might have been a different small venue around that year at the time. But yeah, just playing. He just went with requests after a while. He played through his own set once or twice and then just did requests from the handful of people who were still hanging around to hear him play.
Were you there at the famous Schnapps incident? Does that ring a bell?
I don't remember it, but I did go to, I thought I went to pretty well...
One gig which went on very late, and the management was so pleased with how he'd done, and obviously we'd all spent a shitload of money at the bar, that they came out with this tray of assorted schnapps, little glasses, little shot glasses with schnapps in.
I think that'd be for the VIPs, I reckon.
And No. Because the idea was it would be passed around the whole audience, and so they first went to Nick as a, you know, courtesy, of course.
Yeah.
And presented this tray to him, and he had a schnapps and put it on the tray, and then he got another one. And the woman hadn't moved away in time. He picked another one up and drank that. He carried on, and he had like 10 or 12 of them.
Oh my god. Well, I don't remember that at all.
Right. And then eventually some of the audience got some schnapps, but most of them had been drunk by Nick. And I've spoken to him about it afterwards, and he says he can't remember too much about the evening.
He doesn't remember either.
But he woke up... No, actually, no. He was with a mate of his, and his mate woke up the next morning with a bottle of tomato ketchup by his bed.
Oh,
he was trying to work out what had happened. It was one of those, you know...
they were mad nights at the 12 bucks.
They were.
I got to meet a woman called Mel around that era, who used to go to a number of... Nick concerts.
I knew Mel quite well. Yeah.
And she shared my passion in specialist biscuits that one used to munch if you enjoyed dancing lots in the evening.
Right.
And she got in the habit of bringing these chocolate hobnobs down to Nick. I recall two or three of these gigs being in a very unusual frame of mind watching Nick on the stage, which is extra entertainment value. And in fact, on one of those nights, Nick came and joined me and Mel after the gig. I think is it Ben, Nick's brother?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Ben was there that night, and we all went off to some dubious seedy blues club somewhere Soho to carry on the evening. It was it was very entertaining, and God knows how I got back to Reading. But in those days, I had to somehow get back to Reading on public transport, and goodness knows what time that evening finished.
The last I heard from Mel was that she'd got married... somebody living somewhere exotic, I can't remember, and she went out somewhere exotic, I can't remember where it was, but then eventually came back to the UK, presumably with her husband, but I haven't seen her for years.
I only ever saw her, obviously, at these Nick gigs, and, just on a handful of occasions, and they were very entertaining gigs.
Oh yeah.
But I think it's interesting, I think Nick's music does appeal more to women than Roy's does. I don't know if there's something about Roy's that's very male oriented.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think Nick crosses boundaries a bit more.
I think you're right. I mean, he's easy to get into initially. The songs are more accessible, and the covers help as well, because people have a familiar tunes, like what we were saying before about having to sort of put a bit of time in first to know the tracks. But you're right. He does have a higher percentage of ladies following.
Yeah. I reckon so. One of my best mates who's sadly dead now, my friend Debsy, she got into going to see Nick with me and went to many gigs with me and then went to quite a few on her own. She was based for a long time and had friends around the Brighton area, and I would imagine went to many of the gigs that Dave and Sue put on in Brighton.
Yes, marvellous.
Marvellous things. I went to one or two with her down there, but I think she went to probably most of them, I would imagine. And she really got into going to see Nick. And sadly, she died a couple of years ago of cancer. And I always remember because she asked me, she was going to go and see this gig at the Half Moon, and she was sadly too ill to go.
Right.
And she knew she wouldn't be able to make it. And she asked me to ask Nick to play a song for her. And I met Nick on that tour at a gig at the London Met, London Metropolitan University. And it was a weird gig. There were probably eight people in the audience, including me. And I was incredibly inebriated, drunk that night. I was dealing with this sad news about my friend. Why I'd be drinking more than I should do. And I remember in a very drunken way, eventually sort of plucking up courage to ask Nick to, if he would mind playing this song, which is, I used to think if it was the one called I Hope She's Okay, but more poignantly, I guess its official title is Before They Put Me in the Ground.
That's right.
And I asked him to play it, if he'd mind playing it for Debsy, because he knew who Debsy was at the Half Moon gig.
Mm.
And he was quite shocked about the news. As an aside, there's an interesting tale how Nick got to meet me and Debsy. Me and Debsy were going around on a tour of Wales one year for around her birthday, and we were sort of fitting it in around Nick gigs, as you do. And we got to see him. I think it was either Swansea or Cardiff in this dreadful venue that was... It was in the days when there were regular late-night licences.
Oh, yeah.
And at this venue, it stayed out until, say, 4 a.m. And Nick's concert was scheduled, I don't know, 9 till 11. But, of course, it was full of people who were there purely because they wanted to drink late.
There
were possibly three people in the audience who cared a monkeys about Nick's music, and 200 people who just wanted to get really, really drunk. And it's the only time I've seen Nick abort a gig, and he did it for the very best reasons, because after about three tracks, this random Welsh nutter just runs up to the stage where Nick's manfully trying to battle against this horrendous background noise, and goes and grabs Nick's balls and squeezes really hard while Nick's in the middle of a song. And it's a credit to Nick's professionalism.
God.
Somehow managed to finish the song off without A, whacking the guy in the head, and B, his voice going up a couple of octaves. But shortly after that, I think he threw in the towel. And
you have to wonder what goes through somebody's mind when to do something like that. I mean, that's just weird.
It's weird, and it was a horrible venue, horrible, horrible night. And Nick came and sat with me and Debsy and chatted for half an hour after.
Oh, right.
He sort of chucked the towel in, and before he went back, he was obviously pissed off that he hadn't been given a chance to show what he could do, and then that had happened. But anyway, so that's how, to cut a long story short, that's how I think basically Nick got introduced to Debsy. And so he remembered when I asked him, if he'd do that song, and he said, yeah, I'll do it. And then, of course, he went to the Half Moon, and halfway through the night, he said, oh, I've got something I'm going to have to try and play. My voice isn't really up to it, but I know it means something to somebody in particular, and so I'm going to try and do it. And he played the song. So that was really, really nice of him, and I think it meant an awful lot to my friend when I got back and went to visit her at her home where she was spending the last few months, and told her that Nick actually did the song, and I had a little phone video of the event as well that I was able to show.
Oh, that was so great, yeah.
That was really nice. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that Debsy got so into his music, and several other people I know, women I've known, have really got into Nick's music, people who just would have walked away or probably ran away if that played them any of Roy's.
Mm. Yeah, that song actually is... I'm just thinking about it when you were talking there. It must have been a very poignant experience, knowing he was playing it for her, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether you get to that age, I'm a lardy old so-and-so of nearly 50 years, and you get to an age where, people that you really know and really care a lot about, people do die. And
yeah.
It changes your life if that person is really close, if you're really close to that, if they're a family member or if they're a really close friend, and... Things are really different from then on, and at that point in time, I was really struggling to hold it together at the gig and things when Nick dedicated the song to us. It was an emotional evening.
But that also goes back to the thing about music. You associate music with certain times of, and events in your life as well. So for you, that track will always mean something special.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and I can play different Roy stuff or whatever, whatever artist it is, and it does sort of evoke a certain memory or mood. If something you know, really important happened, and I was listening to that album a lot at the time, you know, it really takes you back to it.
Definitely. I just hope something, I mean, that's a very poignant and powerful and sad memory in many ways that I linked to now, as you say there, I now associate with that song. I just hope that at some point in the future there'll be something positive, a nice thing will happen that I'll also get to associate that song. So,
yeah.
You know, I can look at it in different ways as well. Interesting, you're talking about the power of music. This is another part of my insanity. I don't think a rational person would do anything as stupid as this. But at a Nick gig in Reading, a friend of mine put on a Nick gig in his studio called Plug and Play Studios.
Oh, right,
in Reading.
Right.
And there's only a small number of people there, perhaps 40 or 50 people in the audience. And it was, to me, perhaps, it's certainly in the top three Nick gigs I've ever been to. Everything about it was just perfect. The sound was great. Nick was on form. Beautiful, beautiful song selection he chose.
Yeah.
The audience, most of whom did not know Nick at all, really got into what Nick was doing. And it was a magical night. And I'd gone down there with this girl I just started going out with. And I was sitting at the front, enjoying every second of Nick's performance. And it wasn't just your normal Nick. Nick is always brilliant, but this was like awesomely brilliant. And I was thinking to myself, God, I can't imagine anyone in the whole world not being moved by this. It's just the most magical night of all time.
Mm.
And then I looked back and I saw my mate chatting to her mate at the bar, not paying the slightest attention to this music. And it just really cut me down. I thought, God. You know, Nick's music was so connecting to something really deep inside me. I thought, living out, this does not bode well for the future. Insanely enough, very soon after that night, the aforesaid young lady went separate ways.
But that's also about the subjective nature of music. You're right, you can get so wrapped up in the moment that you believe that everybody else will feel the same as you do, but it's, you know, everybody interprets things in a different way and is looking for different things. I guess
definitely.
That's...
I think I'm not a great fan, I don't know, of say, Dire Straits, for argument's sake. I'd be hard-pressed to name two of their songs. But
right.
I can imagine, if my partner, which she isn't, I hasten to add, in case she ever gets to listen to this, but if she was a great Dire Straits fan, and they played the best gig that Dire Straits have ever played, and everybody in the audience was just electrified by this dynamic that was on stage, and I knew that my partner was a huge Dire Straits fan,
yeah,
I think I'd be a bit weird. I'd find it a bit odd not to try and at least make an attempt to get into what was going on.
Ah, yeah, but that's because you're a music lover in general, isn't it? You understand what's going on, and you know you could appreciate artistic excellence even if it doesn't make that emotional connection, maybe. Yeah. But not everybody's like that.
Well, as you said, everyone is different. And I know I'm on the extreme case of the mad side of this divide in the world. So.
Well, talking about everybody being different, of course, is a nice link to talk about The Green Man, which has split opinions quite severely amongst the amongst the Harper community. And I believe you have some interesting things to say about that album.
Well, God knows whether they're interesting, but I certainly know that it's meant a lot to me. I've chatted over the years. I've got to recognise and say a few words and have a bit of a chat with her if I see her around, and I know that it's not one of her favourite pieces of music that Roy's ever recorded, and for me it is. I'd put it for me in my certainly my top five of Roy's output, and but I remember the day. I do you remember the Green Man? What Roy did was release as a download the title track CD was released.
Yeah.
And I remember getting this on MP3 and playing it to death and absolutely loving it, because unlike you, I loathed the Dream Society. It is, for me, the Dream Society to me is what the Green Man is to L. I can see no redeeming features in it at all. Right. Admittedly, I've only played it two or three times ever, but it just leaves me stone cold. And I always associate it with going to see Roy at the 12 Bar Club and really not enjoying the concert as well. I think I saw him twice and I just could not get in to this Dream Society music. Yeah, right. And those couple of gigs, I didn't connect with what Roy was doing at that point, you know, and that's just the way it was for me. I'm sure everybody else did, but it didn't work for me. But anyway, so I was, when the Green One came along, to me that was like a return to the Roy that I really loved, this sort of pastoral, mythical, slightly supernatural sort of big soundscape, and so many different metaphors and images going on in that song, that it really, really connected to me on umpteen different levels, and I was dying for the CD to arrive. And sure enough, it eventually turned up on my doorstep. I'd ordered it, like a lot of the Roy fans, as you know, prepared for it to be delivered as soon as it was out. And I dashed over to the CD player, popped it on, and bugger me, I listened to it, and I hated it. I felt it was Roy by numbers.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that.
It was sexist. That I found that song, was it Sexy Woman, literally risible. I hated the tribute to Glastow. I found it just trite, pathetic. Mm-hmm. I loathed it. And I found, I didn't like it at all. Every track, apart from the title track, I just didn't get into it. And I just remember that's these lyrics. I mean, I always remember listening to this one particular lyric that just, for me, I've always loathed it. It goes, "I love you, dear, like Guinevere." Yeah. And when I heard that, I just thought, oh my God, this is just grim. And I just could not get into that record for ages and ages. And I kept playing it because I did like the title track. And then, weirdly, after a few months, I had a bit of a gap and I popped it on again.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, it was like snapping into a different world. I suddenly enjoyed it. I didn't just enjoy one track, I enjoyed all of it. And suddenly, tracks like, I don't know, Glastow, instead of being just ridiculous, they were suddenly sort of tracks that an old guy who's been to umpteen festivals in his time might write, kind of mocking the people who go along, what was it, the giggly schoolgirls from the spring, but in a gentle, warm way. It's not a nasty, vitriolic taking the piss of people who go to Glastonbury. It's a warm, gentle taking the piss of people who go to Glastonbury, and it's warm, and it's also praising, I think, some of the nice things about it. And I think it's, people say it's Roy by numbers, but I think it's sort of Roy, you know, an older Roy who's writing about things, and he's reinterpreting styles and musical modes that he's used in the past, yes, to give this like reflective elder view on things. And so eventually Glastow began to work for me, much to my astonishment. And then, who's the guy from the Teapot Party or who plays on?
Tea Party. Jeff Martin.
Jeff Martin. I like tea, for those of you who don't know. My
favourite. Oh, yeah, me too.
Does he play on Sexy Woman? I think he does, doesn't he?
Oh, he might do.
And that track, the sort of rockiness of that eventually grabbed me. And then I really got into Monster. I just think Monster is an epic that ranks
great.
With its best. I mean, there's no one left to vote for, only fools to vote against.
Never a word spoken.
Yeah, and it's just really pithy, accurate sort of Roy for me, Roy at his best. So eventually, much to my shock, and after it took a lot of plays, but all of a sudden the Green Man snapped into focus for me, and it now is one of my fave Roy LPs. But,
that is fascinating. You know,
I know that people hate it and probably never will like it.
Well, that's inspired me to listen to it again, because I haven't listened to that one for a long, long time.
So you're with Elle on this one, are you?
No, I don't hate it. It's just that, given the choice of that or, I don't know, Stormcock or whatever, I'll just naturally go towards something that I kind of feel is more classic, if you like.
Yeah, but that's kind of comparing gold to diamond, isn't it? I mean, Stormcock is in the pantheon of all-time epic albums.
Well,
and
that's true.
I mean, I mean, and I think a fairer comparison might be, do you want to play the Green Man or Unknown Soldier or the Green Man?
Or,
I don't know. I was going to say HQ, but that's another one, in my opinion, one of Roy's stompers. But,
it is.
You get the vibe where I'm coming from. I think it's perhaps not his best LP, but I think it's one that stands up there, you know, with his good
pineapple. That was an interesting defence, and actually I think this might be a good excuse to put Green Man tracks on the podcast, because I haven't done that for a while, so I'll find one or two to put on. Any suggestions?
The Monster is something I really love.
Right.
So I've enjoyed listening to that. But I know, as I say, I like all of them. Mm. Wasn't one of those tracks something he wrote, originally put out on a charity LP?
Was it Glasto?
Something solo.
Oh, yeah. Solo in Sculptures. That's right.
For some charity, for some girl who had cancer or something. I can't remember the details.
It wasn't cancer, no. It was not. Was it Downs or something like that? Yeah. I've got the CD, actually. And bizarrely, it's actually quite good, because it's a whole mixture of tracks that have been donated by people. And the guy who put the CD together was a DJ at one of the BBC local radio stations. Okay. But he's heavily into prog rock. So it's got lots of interesting people, from my point of view, interesting stuff on there, as well as Roy as well. So that was quite a nice find, that was.
I forgot that. I keep forgetting that you like prog rock, Paul. But if you do, I mean, I think I've been to millions of festivals over the years. But there's one in particular I think was the, if you like prog, was the ultimate one. I don't know whether you ever went to it. It was Canterbury Fair.
Yes, right? I was there. It was brilliant. Brilliant.
We had Roy and Nick and Hawkwind and Robert Plant, as I recall.
That's right.
Numerous proggy bands as well.
Yeah, David Sinclair, or no, Richard Sinclair was playing, and he actually had a record shop selling records there as well, and I got to meet him. But I also remember that very well, because that was the famous Mushroom Stall year. At that point, there was still a legal loophole that you could sell mushrooms of a certain nature, as long as they weren't prepared. I think that was the story.
Are these the ones to have in the Mushroom Valley in the sun?
Yeah, I believe it might be. And I seem to remember a bunch of us buying these things, and then things getting a bit cosmic after that.
Excellent.
Really good. Really good.
Did you go to see Space Ritual then at that festival in the little tent? I think it was either after.
Oh, Nick. I remember people were really enthusiastic about going, but I can't remember seeing them. So.
Oh, you didn't remember, because they had burlesque dancers on stage with Nick Turner in a rubber suit.
I would have remembered that, yes.
But well worth the view. If anyone likes Hawkwind, go and check out Space Ritual. There's more original members of Hawkwind in that band than there are in Dave Brock's Hawkwind these days.
Oh, and just going back to Glasto for a moment, I made a mental note to talk to you about it. He wrote that song because he'd played at the acoustic tent at Glastonbury previous year. And I know that because I was there.
I was. Was that the time when the seats broke?
No. This was quite a while after that.
Ah, right. Well,
The thing about the girl from Tring was because there was a couple of guys doing this naked protest, which, as far as I can tell, involved just wandering about with a sign and with no clothes on.
Yeah.
And one of them did have a bit of a corkscrew appendage.
Excellent.
And I can remember Roy talking about that quite a lot. So obviously, you know, this is how the songs get formulated, with experiences. Exactly. And it's, quite funny.
I really enjoyed those gigs of Roy's in the acoustic stage. And I particularly remember that year, and I think, was it Dave and Sue who talked about this at length, when the seating collapsed.
That's
in
right.
The acoustic.
That's right, yeah.
And that was utterly mad, because there were people underneath where I was sitting on the stand, and God knows how they avoided getting crushed when the seating collapsed.
It's a scary thought, isn't it?
It was a mad gig.
Oh, and talking of gigs, you've also made a note about the 100 Club gigs.
This is the recent ones, the more recent ones.
Yeah, the recent ones. The last batch of sort of really concentrated ones that we had, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, again, I know I'm in a minority of one probably about all this, and I preface all this with the usual rider that I've just got weird taste. But for me, seeing Roy with somebody else on stage, it's just kind of sad, really. I just, my, as I said, my beautiful memories of Roy being the one-man rock and roll band with Jackie mixing. And before that, the great memories I have of him, you know, like at Stonehenge, playing perhaps, you know, with a less amplified sound. And he used to use his Ovation more often and enjoying that. But he was always Roy on his own. And Roy with anybody else, I don't know. I guess I don't like it because it takes away the spontaneity of the gig, to me, anyway. I can't imagine going to, like, six gigs at the 100 Club with Matt Churchill and the set changing, a third of the set changing every night, because Matt has to, there has to be a structure so that Matt can do his things along with Roy.
And, Do you feel the same about Nick? Do you feel the same about when Nick plays with him?
This is where I'm irrational here, because I like Nick so much and Nick and Roy together that I, for some reason, always enjoy what Nick and Roy do. But I guess they must have had a lifetime of playing together and perhaps have an even closer relationship when it comes to music than perhaps Matt and Roy do. I don't know, but I just find the gigs with Mark Churchill, I know Matt's a fantastic guitarist. As a guitarist, I can respect what he does, but to me, they're very sterile. And I think, was it 1 year that he did about three nights on the... It was every week, I can't remember now, at the 100 Club, not that long ago, a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And I went to a couple of them, and I ended up going to all three, actually, because I went to two, and thought, I'm not really enjoying this, I'm not going to go to the next one. And a mate of mine, I hadn't seen Roy since the birthday concert, and happened to be in London that day, rang, he says, "Oh, Mark, I want to go and see Roy, you've got to come along." So off I popped in and ended up going to that one as well. And I enjoyed it. I mean, you can't, if you're a Roy fan, I don't think you can really ever go to a concert and not enjoy seeing Roy play. But to me, I think, you know, I always have these memories of these halcyon days of seeing Roy in his prime, what to me is his prime, and it might not be for everybody, but what I loved, and that's that wall of sound with Jackie and the days playing at the festivals. And so seeing this sort of guy on stage, and I just wonder whether, I don't know, I mean, I don't know what, I know Roy's been a bit ill these days, and I just wonder whether he's having to help, you know, whether he needs someone on stage with him these days to, you know, to keep him on the straight and narrow to get through the songs.
It's an interesting point. And I actually do understand where you're coming from, and I'm not entirely unsympathetic with what you're saying. And I can remember when Matt Churchill first started playing with him, I wasn't really that taken with it. And eventually I kind of tuned into it and I thought, yeah, he's actually adding subtle little frills and feels. But does he really need to be there? And I wasn't really sure that he did.
Well, for me, I don't think he does. But, I mean, Roy has his own reasons for having Matt on stage with him. And,
yeah.
You know, and I've got to respect, you know, Roy for wanting to move in that direction. There's clearly reasons for that. But equally well, you know, in my opinion, those nights aren't quite as enjoyable. I'd rather have a shambolic Roy on his own, where he's a bit stoned or pissed or whatever, and rambling through with a few ad libs to the audience and playing playing an impassioned version of 12 songs than a note perfect,
is
sort of a clean set when there's no little audience interaction and everything is very antiseptic.
I also think part of it is that he underestimates his own guitar ability, because I know that he's not very he considers it as a means to an end to present the lyrics, really, and I don't think he realizes that people like his particular idiosyncratic way of playing as much as they do.
The mad thing is, I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of a night when I've noticed Roy's guitaring being particularly off.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember numerous nights where he's had trouble remembering the lyrics to various songs. But then again, this is a man who's got a huge output and will quite happily, if someone shouts for it and he's in the mood, he'll probably play for anything. So you can't knock the guy for perhaps not remembering every song that he's, the lyrics for every song he's ever made.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd agree with you. I don't think in all those 50 gigs I've seen one where he's guitar work was particularly off. I just can't think of it.
The only thing I would say is I wish he'd get a bit better at tuning the bloody thing. But that's a different conversation.
Well, didn't someone say that Roy doesn't believe that electric guitar tuners work? And if that quote is true, I reckon it's because he just randomly gives guitar to whatever sound is in his head at any point in time. So no guitar tuner's got a hope in hell of killing the last thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're reaching the end of our pre-written list of topics, but I've got a couple of standard questions, as you rightly predicted beforehand. And I suppose the first one is an easy one. What, or not easy, what do you think is his best record?
I'm struggling not to say the obvious cliche. And I'm fighting. I'm in my office at work, and I've got my hands forcing my mouth not to say. It's come out. It's Stormcock, I'm afraid. It's got to be my favourite Roy record of all time, by some considerable distance. Although I also love HQ, particularly not so much the record, which is sort of electrified, but the songs on HQ.
The songwriting's fantastic. Yeah, there's not a duff one on that at all.
No, not at all. And so yeah, I guess those two LPs, and just for, I think the Dream Society, I'd have to put up there as well for me. That's something that I always enjoy.
Would I be right in saying that Work of Heart might be at the bottom?
Yes, although actually I'm not that keen on that Smith thing either from the early days. Out Genghis Smith. There's a couple of tracks on there that really.
I like that, but it kind of it. Part of the reason I like it is because it just feels like it's late 60s, and it seems it's got that kind of. Oh, you know, it's a period piece almost.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. And for some reason, that period pieceness on Folk Joke Opus, I can get into. And I really like, well, all the tracks on Folk Joke Opus, including, in fact, if you ask me to name my favourite Roy track of all time, it would either be Me and My Woman or McGowan's Blues. Difficult to choose between. But I really like some of the other tracks on Folk Joke Opus as well, and Sergeant Sunrise and She's the One in particular for me, two really great standout tracks. But on Come Out Fighting Genghis Smith, I'm hard pressed. I know there are two or three tracks on that I like, but I can't even think of the names, which is a bit shaming, but there we go. So yeah, that's one that I'm not so keen on. But Work of Heart, but I love the, what was it released as? Born in Captivity, wasn't
it?
The outtake version, that is fantastic.
It is, it's much better.
I really love it. And particularly as we were talking about Mushroom songs earlier on, I really love the version of the Mushroom Valley song on there as well.
Yes.
That's great.
Same question but for Nick, while we're here. What do you think Nick's...
I feel put on a spot. I hadn't anticipated.
I know. Well, I had to catch you out with something.
You definitely have. I'm struggling. I mean, for me, most of Nick's LPs I really love. I was going to say Light at the End of the Kennel. That's one I love always. But then the track Blood Song just sends shivers down my spine every time. And then Treasure Island, of course, is just superb. I just don't know. Let's pick one. Obviously, the live album is fantastic.
I was going to say that would be my choice if I was allowed to, you know. But it's
it'd be one. Remember when that live album came out? I loved it so much. I bought an extra copy and posted it to the music critic of the Independent, who I went embarrassing by naming her because I knew her very, very slightly through another friend at that period in time. And I got a very polite letter back saying, no, I'm not going to review this just because he's there. And in future, I suggest you get Roy's management to email, Nick's management to email. So that little, my little attempt to try and get Nick a bit more national coverage failed miserably. But yeah, that's a really great live CD.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I think I'll just for madness, I'm going to go for an off-the-track one. I'll go for Treasure Island this time. And I think the poem at the end of that is awesome.
Oh, it is. It's great, yeah.
Really nice tracks on there, particularly some of the knuckle draggers and some of the heavy tracks are really good.
Okay, and my final standard question about the music industry. We've already covered it a bit, I think, but more and more musicians, I think, are starting to say, look, you know, everybody expects music to be free. We can't make any money out of the recordings, and they're having to find other ways of doing it. And all the large record companies are all crying into their into their checkbooks or whatever, because they're just not making the money now. Where's it going to go? Is it just going to be all internet stuff, do you think, or what's going to happen? Is the industry going to find some amazing DRM, digital rights management?
I hope to God that it doesn't. I really loathe DRM.
Me too.
When I used to buy an LP, I never had to worry which LP player I played it on, and it pees me off that when I buy a track from, say, iTunes, I'm only like, is it five machines I'm allowed to play on?
That's
on
right.
Stuff.
Yeah,
that's
stupid.
Really niggled me. Stupid. But yeah, in the future, I mean, do you remember the bit at the beginning to I Hate the White Man on Flat Baroque where Roy does little diatribe about the music industry?
Yeah.
And I've always sort of harkened back to that, and I think in a slightly different context, I guess, but I think the music industry is evolving. I mean, there's been a period in time in the heydays of the 70s and early 80s where big artists could earn mega bucks by releasing, you know, very big selling LPs. I think those days it probably numbered. I would imagine it'll get harder and harder for artists to shift industrial quantities of CDs. I reckon they'll probably carry on being a handful of people who can do that, but their number will get fewer, I would imagine, as the years go on. And I think. But what I think is that artists in the music industry will make money in different ways. And we've already heard Nick say that he makes most of his money from live music. I think that goes for people like Madonna and the Rolling Stones. I think, you know, you don't have to be a smaller, a less well-known artist for live music to be your primary income stream these days. And I gather that, you know, for the Rolling Stones, Madonna and people of that ilk, live music is a huge source of money to them. And for the smaller artists, people say, oh, it's hard, nicking, you know, downloading tracks is really bad. I gather, what's her name, Lily Allen is in the paper this morning, today, berating people who download music and berating somebody from Pink Floyd. Was it Mason? Somebody Mason? I can't remember.
Nick Mason.
To my surprise, this guy from Floyd was saying, yeah, go and download music, why not? And Lily Allen was saying this is really bad, it's bad for up-and-coming artists. But I'm not convinced it is. I think if you use the internet wisely, you can. It's easy for a band. You don't necessarily need a record label. You can get your product out to an audience without having a record label. It's infinitely easier than it was probably 15, 20 years ago to get exposure. And you can make money if you do things inventively. I think one of the things that I've seen, for example, a band called the Pixies do is to sell after the gig CDs or downloads of the night of that night's gig. You know, that's another income stream. I think people have got to be more creative. Got to be more creative about where they get their money from. But because we can all go and download the CD version if you wanted to of the Pixies' new album, but you can't so easily go and get the gig that you were actually present at. So people are more prepared to pay money for things like that. As I suggested earlier on, I'd love to see Roy maintain a bootleg library and charge people to download them some, you know, moderate amount of money.
Yeah.
And then there's always merchandise and things like that. And I just think there's licensing deals you can do. So for the big artists, they can license their music, perhaps get it used on adverts and things. And for little artists, you've got to be imaginative. But I'm convinced it's probably easier now to make a living out of the music business than it's ever been. That's my 2 pence worth for the little it's worth.
Very interesting. And it's what you're saying is it all comes down to not getting stuck in a rut and being prepared to think of different ways of doing things. And that's the trouble, because the establishment have got this mindset where they cannot change anything.
It's a nonsense. It's like that. You can't fight change. I mean, people have got so used now to getting their music for free. Young people, like, I still buy my music. I'm one of the silly so-and-sos who will go to iTunes and pay. I haven't downloaded any music for many, many, many years since I first found it available. I just prefer to. I'm lucky I've got a job, I can afford to buy the odd bit of music that I want. I'll just go to iTunes and check. That's convenient and easy. I just don't understand the record companies when they're fighting this, what to me is a losing battle against people downloading music, because that's the way I think younger people today just see they're going to get most of their music. Okay. But it doesn't matter as much. To me, music was such an enormous part of my life, and I also don't see necessarily that people have the same relationship to music.
Oh, yeah.
People in 16, 17, and 18. As I had when I was 16, 17 and 18.
I agree 100% with that. I mean, I think you still do get people that are really, really into it, but it also seems to just be more disposable. It's more of a commodity to a lot of people, rather than something that is so central to their life for a while.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, music's been such a huge part of my life and the scene around music. A sort of defining element, I guess. And it's, you know, it's strange. I mean, a lot of people would think that's a bizarre way to live, but you know, it meant something to me as I've passed through the years. But now it doesn't seem to be so obvious that I've got friends, I've got children who are 16, 17, 18 years old, and it just doesn't seem so obvious to me that they're as passionate in the way I was at that age, you know, about music. It's just something that's one part of the informational stream that floods their heads, and there are many other things.
Yeah. Right, well, we've time to wrap it up, I suppose, Marco. It's been really an interesting chat, but is there anything else you want to talk about or mention that we've not covered?
Yeah. Well, just to keep the conversation going longer to the annoyance of the listeners, I guess. But there's one other thing that's kind of I find weird about Roy, and I don't know whether anyone else has, and that's his book. Was it Passions of Great Fortune?
Yeah.
Is that the I got that as a present, I think last Christmas, and I've been going through it. And I don't know whether you've noticed this, but I mean, in there are pieces about the songs. And it seems to me over the years, Roy, I've seen this in press, and I gather he spent some time recently trying to do this about the tracks on Stormcock. But Roy feels a need to try and explain ad nauseum everything about about all his songs, including how he sees it, what their meaning is. And I kind of find that bizarre, because I'm a great believer that the songs will mean one thing to Roy, but they'll mean another thing to me and another thing to you, and another thing, if you remember the woman, is it Susan Egan?
Yes.
He used to write about this on the list a few years ago. I think she made this precise. What did you call her? Bad Susan?
Mad Susan.
Mad Susan, yeah. She used to moan about Roy trying to say, this is the meaning of this song. And I've got some sympathy with that view, because my partner, my girlfriend, is a modern literary critic, and her special oeuvre is Virginia Woolf, but she's at
right
speed on literary criticism per se. And there's part of the last century, there's been a big movement away from the idea that there is one interpretation of a text. People
right
have begun to realise post-Derrida that you can read, you know, that a reader brings his or her own life experiences to any text, and the idea that there's one canonical reading of a text is, most people don't, in literary criticism, don't take that altogether seriously these days. And yet, it seems Roy's constantly trying to say, this is how this song should be understood, this is how that one should be understood. And I think if Roy was writing an autobiography and wanted to say how these songs came about and how they meant something to him, that would be legitimate. But I find it a bit bizarre when he tries to say that is the canonical interpretation of how this song should be interpreted, because, I personally see things in a sort of slightly more liberal way, I guess. And the other thing about that book that I find uncomfortable, and I don't know what your opinion on this is the use of kind of quite explicit photographs of Roy's exes.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm also some sort of pervy sado voyeur when I look at these things. I've got no great desire to be made to feel that way when I'm looking at a book about Roy's tracks. And I also find it, and I wonder, I can't help wondering whether all those people have given their permission for those quite intimate photographs to be used. Certainly, I believe at least one of the people featured therein will now be dead.
Yeah.
And I just don't feel comfortable about using a photograph, if it was me, of having an intimate photograph of an ex and then that person died, of slapping that in a book which is available for the public to buy. I feel uncomfortable about that.
Presumably you're talking about Nick's mum there. And I can't. Yeah, I actually know exactly what you mean. And I know Roy is one part of him has got this very kind of erotic nature. He's a very, you know, that's part of his life and that's part of how he lives his life. And I think his intent probably is to portray that as being, you know, part of the whole package.
Yeah, when it happens for live, you know, when he's living his life, good on him. I certainly don't think of myself as any old crude. but what Roy's now, he's not in his first flush of youth. And I don't know, it just, to me...
It depends.
Perhaps, I mean, again, a minority form, but I find it a bit bizarre.
It depends what he was trying to achieve with the book. Because... I don't know whether I should say this, but I'm going to anyway. I did once see a draft of the Roy Harper book, many years ago.
Is this the legendary book that was actually going to be a book rather than a collection of
and I saw some proofs shown to me by a certain person who should remain nameless, called Darren. and it looked great, and it really was what you've just said about the and at this time of my life I was doing this and that, and this happened, and it was a really great autobiography based thing. And at some point he decided to put that to one side or throw it away and go back to this whole thing about structuring it around the albums and the lyrics and everything and the photos. So and it's kind of sitting between a lyric book and a biography, and the photos I think are in there for him to sort of look at different parts of periods of his life and see what was going on and who he was with and all that. But it doesn't have the kind of glue to glue them into what was happening and why it was happening and then how the songs came out of it. So
I'll bet there'll be hundreds of people listening to this podcast who've read Roy's book and who will really get into exactly what Roy's trying to do with it, and we're really glad that Roy released the book that he did release. But just speaking personally, it's all I can do. I would have so much more enjoyed reading Roy's autobiography or his take on his life, interspersed with some of those photographs perhaps, interspersed with references to his songs, rather than this book that tells me that I find tries to dictate a little bit how one ought to interpret meaning of the songs, and with some photographs that.
I am with you on the interpretation and the validity of every individual's interpretation, because that's a side effect of what we were saying before about, you know, the music being linked in with your life and the way you think. But on the other hand, sometimes he can point something out in a lyric, and I don't have an exact example for you, but it's some really lovely comparison or word construct that I'd completely missed, and I like that aspect of it—the revelation of certain things. It's like
that's like a conflating like intent, Roy's intent when he writes something with the meaning of the piece. I think they're two different things. Roy can intend to show, as you said, by some beautiful word construction, you know, just to create a particular image, and he might be successful with some people, and some of the people might not get that illusion. But I think that's to do with his intent, rather than to say that is what the song means, and it's the latter that seems to me problematic. But sorry, I cut you off there.
No, that's fine. This is an interesting topic. Maybe we'll get some...
Well, I mean, it kind of relates to one of the things I used to do at work with. I spent a lot of time looking at computers and trying to get computers to understand meaning and... Yeah. There's a very famous philosophical argument by a guy called John Searle called the Chinese Room Argument, that some people, if you're a computer geek, might have come across in your time. And this purports to show that the mere application of rules can't ever be enough on its own to generate semantics or meaning from a piece. Mm-hmm. And I think this is linked in a kind of an analogous way. You can't just put some rules on Roy's writing and hope to get the meaning of it, because part of that meaning is to do with our own life experience. Sorry, I went off on one there.
No, that's... I'd like to hear from more people about what you've said, particularly about the book, but also about the whole interpretation. Yeah. It's an interesting topic. It's one I'd like to come back to at some point.
And if any of you in the audience are interested in finding out more about meaning and consciousness and the mind, I hope perhaps Paul might be persuaded to put a link to the course I run at Goldsmiths.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The computing, where... we spend a lot of time looking at those areas.
It'd be a pleasure. Right. Well, I don't know about you. I've got a very numb bum now. Sat down for, well, in terms of recording, I think we've been at it for about an hour and a half. So yeah, that's not too bad, is it? any final last words to the audience? Anything you want to say to everybody?
I think I'm last worded out. I think I feel I've rambled on far too much. And I just hope that some people find it a little bit
interesting. No, it's been really, really great. And you've had some very illuminating things to say and also some funny stuff as well. So really good job there, Marco. And I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Let's hope we will meet at a Roy gig at some point. Who knows?
Or even a Boot Led Zeppelin gig.
Oh, yes, maybe, yeah. I'm probably going to do that.
If anyone loves Led Zeppelin as much as I do, as a band touring or Boot Led Zeppelin who aren't a covers band of Led Zeppelin, they are Led Zeppelin incarnate. Jimmy Page has made a pact with the devil, and he's created this band called Boot Led Zeppelin, who give a perfect rendition of what Led Zeppelin, for me, are all about. So check them out if they're in your area.
Excellent. And on that note, Marco, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot, Marco. I really enjoyed our chat, although it was such a long time ago now. Thanks for being so patient to get the second part out. And some of you will be very pleased to hear that since the part one came out, Marco has now become a professor. So he's a professor, Marco. Well done. Now time for some more music, and I was listening to Death or Glory the other day, the remastered version actually from the downloads, just to see how it sounded, and it was quite interesting because I've only ever had the initial print on CD, the first version that came out, and as some of you may know, later on the album was revised a little bit and some of the tracks were reworked, and one of those tracks is The Fourth World. In the new version, there's more percussion, it's got a bit more of a driving edge to it. But I sat down and thought about it a bit, and I actually think I prefer the original version. It's a bit more rough, it's got a little bit more going for it, just in my mind. And I thought it would be interesting to play it to you and see if those of you that are only familiar with the current version might agree with me. So, The Fourth World, original version.
Time to fly in the face of a lie. It is over to slave for ideals that have long been ordeals. Must be over. So come on, you men, don't get conned yet again. Find an out, you got out. Must be over. Gotta be over. Over. Oh, good. Sometimes I vote for the man in the coat, but I'm dreaming with community dead and a rat race instead. I'd be dreaming that I could be heard in the state of absurd. Really dreaming, wacko, right out there, for good. You know, in your heart of hearts, in your vision, in your children, that you've got a making star. In this hour of decision, if you are the tabloid caught up in this typhoid of cuckoo, still hoarding the butter in mountains of muttering voodoo, spreading this gospel according to hostile, well, fuck you. Yeah, fuck you. You deserted the spirit forever. sheep. Fuck you for good. Why don't you fuck off with your certified culture? Wimping away to some pasteurized future. Killing the airwaves, gannets for guano. Shit propaganda, Radio Dumbo. People who've got three worlds on sale would rip the fourth apart, repackage you, rip you off, flood the only heart in the sellout. In the sellout. In the sellout. Not brave enough. Change it too low down to inherit the mirror, tell me it's all gonna happen. Happy man, let the doors of perception and justice finally open. All by themselves, without lifting a finger, just by hoping, hoping, just by hoping. Oh, just by opening Pandora box. So fill all those forms in with misinformation and vanish. I'll pass to your children the code they will need to diminish the world that you knew, that you brought them into. For the anguish, for the relish, for the fish, for all of us. You know, in your heart of hearts, in your vision, in your children, that you gotta make it and start. In this hour of decision, now! Now! So pull up a fire and throw down that gun. The fourth world is here, soon there'll either be none. A one global village with faces as bright as the sun. So pull up a fire and throw down that gun. The fourth world is here, soon there'll either be none. A one global village with faces as bright as the sun. One global village with faces as bright as the sun. One global village with faces as bright as the sun.
Now we've just got time for a little bit of listener feedback. First of all, a forum message from Steve T. He says, I've just managed to get the time to listen to episode 27, and as was commented on, I didn't want it to seem as though your efforts and those of the other contributors over the months are taken for granted. Many thanks for what has been a hugely enjoyable and much appreciated series. Like the chap in the feedback, my first Roy LP was the Harvest 70-75 collection, which I bought at the age of 16, just after finishing my O-levels in the summer of 1978. I'd never actually counted back to realise how many years I've been listening to Roy's music and how it has endured while so many other people and passions have come and gone. Thanks again. Well, cheers, Steve. It's not quite the end of this series of podcasts just yet. I think there's life in the old dog yet. Thank you very much for your kind comments. I also got a feedback message from Jeremy Greenwood back in November. So, Jeremy, I didn't forget. I've kept hold of your message. He says, Paul, just wanted to say a big thanks for reconnecting me with Roy News and music over the last few months. I moved to Canada about 7 years ago, and with life generally getting in the way, I haven't listened to him much in recent years. Then I found your podcast through iTunes at the time of the Roy interview and got hooked. I've recently started working my way through the earlier episodes, which is fun, and I don't have to wait a month between episodes. Anyway, I've been listening to a lot more of Roy's music lately and reliving all the reasons why it meant so much when I first discovered it. I first heard Roy when I went to uni in the mid-80s and Jugular was the first album I owned, swiftly followed by trawling second-hand record shops in Liverpool to catch up on the back catalogue. From then until the mid-90s, when I moved to Holland, I tried to see Roy live whenever possible. Some great shows and hazy memories, say no more. I had a day off work today and was driving from Calgary to the Rocky Mountains, about an hour from home. I put the 60th birthday Festival Hall album on at full blast and was totally swept away in the moment. Snowy mountains in front of me, tracks like hallucinating light in my ears. Nice. Thanks again for all your podcasts and keep up the good work, Jez. Thank you very much, Jez. I really appreciate that. And now we have an amazing event. Yes, it's a voicemail.
Hi, Paul. This is Steve Duke from Sydney. I'm sorry for the delay, but here finally is the voicemail that I promised you. And I hope it finds you well. So, I guess first off, I do feel a little odd leaving you this this voicemail, as I'm not part of the Roy Harper community, or was never part of the old mailing list, and I don't know you or any of the people you've interviewed. I've never seen Roy Harper live, and I don't actually have any of his records. And I've never been to the Half Moon in Putney. However, that said, this has certainly got my interests, because I don't listen to enough new stuff anymore, probably like a lot of us. And the Roy Harper music and the various other artists that you've played and who've been guests have been quite interesting. And also, as I said in my email, it's a good insight to life in the old country at the moment, because I left England nearly 20 years ago now to come to Australia. So, I mean, in general, I'd like to say well done. Thank you for your work, because it would be quite easy, I think, for a podcast of this nature to become overly sycophantic and backslapping, if you like, given that your audience are already converts and Roy Harper fans, and you've managed not to do that and to actually keep it interesting and keep it balanced, which isn't easy to do. And I have enjoyed the kind of gradual process, if you like, of discovering Roy Harper and his music. I can't categorically say that I hadn't heard of him before, because I now do have a vague recollection of seeing Roy on the Old Grey Whistle Test when I was a kid. And I know that I had heard his name, because this, I think, would be a familiar story, because I was a fan of Led Zeppelin. So I was talking to a colleague recently at work about favourite albums, and Led Zeppelin 3 came up, and hats off to Harper, and he just said, he asked me, do you know who this Roy Harper guy is? And I said, well, I think he's an English folk singer, but I'm not sure. So we had a look on Google, which led to the Roy Harper site, which led to the Stormcock site, and that's how I came across it. Rather curious as to why I hadn't heard anything about Roy Harper when I lived in England, you know, because I went to uni there, and lots of friends with quite a spectrum of tastes in music, though not including Van de Graaff Generator. Is he the greatest living songwriter, or the genius that a lot of your contributors seem to think? Well, I don't know. maybe I haven't heard enough yet, but I don't know if I would put him in the same sort of category as, let's say, Joni Mitchell or Bob Dylan. And talking of which, yeah, I mean, in songs like Magoon's Blues, I can see a direct line to Bob Dylan, and songs of his like It's All Right, Ma. But I do realise I'm probably flogging a dead horse there, Paul, because you've made your views on Dylan quite clear. I would just say one thing, if you haven't already, it's worth checking out the Martin Scorsese documentary, No Direction Home, of about 3 or 4 years ago. It's not just about Dylan, you know, it's a great little insight into that point in time and the musical scene and the cultural scene, and there's some great live footage that you're probably not going to like. Now, I also suspect from comments of your interviewees and comments online I've come across that there's lots of, shall we say, dross in the Roy Harper catalogue, which you're not going to play on your podcast. Maybe I can draw an analogy to explain what I mean with Lightnin' Hopkins, who I do like. At least I like some of it. Some of his stuff I think is just brilliant, and some of it is just plain dreadful, and it makes me cringe when I listen to it. So you have to know what you're listening for. You have to know what period he was in, what style, whether he was acoustic or electric, was solo or with a band, or whether he was playing guitar or heaven forbid, a piano. So to keep that analogy, I have a challenge for you, Mr. Davison. I would like you to play the worst song that Roy has done in your view on your podcast, one that really kind of makes you cringe. Be interested to hear it. Anyhow, I've rambled on a bit, so thanks again for all your work. If you want to keep it going, that'd be great. I know that you might be under a bit of pressure, in a sense, that you've created a monster now. Whether you keep it going, well, that's up to you. If you do, that would be great. And yeah, given it's now December, best wishes for Christmas and the new year. And as number six would have said, be seeing you.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for that voicemail. And I thought it was really interesting. Steve and I exchanged a few emails towards the end of last year. And it was just fascinating to be talking to somebody who came into the podcast completely cold, if you like, to Roy's music, and was just sort of, you know, picking it up as he went along, not biased in any way. And some of your comments are very, very interesting. And I'd like other people's feedback on some of the things you said. Will I watch the Bob Dylan film? I don't know. Maybe one day when I feel like slashing my wrists, I don't know. Your challenge about a cringeworthy song, I've thought about this a bit. I was going to put the Methane Zone on there, which was originally a throwaway single that came out with Death or Glory and then made its way onto the album. But I decided that I would play, to close off this podcast, Advertisement from Jugular, which actually I like, but it ends in it ends in a rather strange way. I shall say no more. Just before that, credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives Works 2.0 UK England and Wales license, which means you can share it with others freely, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited, and it's not for copying or redistribution. If you want to contact me, pd@stormcock.net. You can send me MP3 voicemails, as Steve did. You can hear from the quality of that that's the best way of sending in audio contributions. But you can also ring the voicemail number. In the UK, it's 01223 850282, or if you're outside the UK, +44 1223 850282. There's a 90-second limit on those, so you'll have to be fairly concise. And that's it for now. I sincerely hope the next podcast will be out rather more swiftly than this one was. A belated Happy New Year to everybody. Let's hope 2010 is a more fiscally stable year, shall we say. And I shall leave you with Advertisement.
Into my other dimension. Hit Kev. Yeah.
could all be sat round.
I must just do something. Hang on.
I get up and I walk across the room. I get to the door, I've been there before, wondering what I got up for. Well, all of a sudden I remember what I was gonna say to you. Standing there watching my member hanging there squirting the loo. Hanging there squirting the loo. Hanging there squirting my shoe.
It's all standing here squirting my bloody shoe.
I'm really stoned, really stoned. To dump yesterday, flush it away. I hope the force is still with me. When sure enough the door flies off its hinges, and there stands PC Bill Identikit, saying I've got trouble finding where I'm going, because my backside is very badly lit. Hello, hello, hello. Backside is very badly lit. My bloody head no longer seems to fit. Hello? You're under arrest and... Hello? I'm really stoned. Thank you.
Maybe the sun.